everybody. I'm Matt Lodi, NEO Sports Insiders, and I am chatting today with one of my good friends from many, many moons ago and a guy that I still run into every now and then at local sporting events. He still does some work with Fox 8 and, of course, also one of the great authors in our market. If you haven't seen it, the new book is out, Let's Have Another. Of course, I'm talking about none other than Dan Coughlin from Fox 8 and, again, one of the great local law authors who's been around for many, many years. Danny, how are you, my friend?
Very good at my age, Matt. Many years, you're not kidding.
Danny, of course, if you don't know, again, I'm sure a lot of you have seen him on Fox 8, but this is one of the great guys when it comes to being a local author. If you don't know, the 1976 Ohio Sports Writer of the Year, two-time Lower Great Lakes Emmy Award winner, and again, a new book is out by Danny. A great Christmas gift, by the way. If you haven't gotten it yet, it's called Let's Have Another. There's some other great books, Danny, you've gotten that I've gotten a chance to read, Past the Nuts, and also Crazy with the Papers to Prove It, Grayco.com. You can get those books there, or of course online at Amazon and all those other great places. Danny,
and it's in all the bookstores. It's in Barnes and Noble and all those legitimate bookstores.
Yep, great, excellent.
That haven't gone out of business yet.
Yeah, right, exactly. Everything now is online. So let's talk about Let's Have Another. Again, coming off the first two books that you wrote recently with Grayco, Crazy with the Papers to Prove It, and Past the Nuts. You talk a lot about great stories from the book, about teams, about your time in the business. Let's talk a little bit about that. And what inspired you to do book number three, first of all?
Well, the property taxes. I'm trying to keep up with them. But, you know, when I did the first book and talking with the publisher, David Gray from Gray & Company, he said, now, you're aware, aren't you, that when you write a book, you're going to be working for about 25 cents an hour.
Oh, yeah.
Project what you're going to make. And, well, that was, you know, that was an exaggeration on the low side. No, I've done. But, for, you know, when I took the buyout from Channel 8, what was that, 6, 7 years ago, something like that, people had been saying to me, and I reacted finally to what people had been saying for years, you ought to write a book about all those characters that you used to write about when you were at the Plain Dealer. We're talking about, you know, a generation ago, back in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, when I spent 18 years at the Plain Dealer, and that's when I was writing about these wonderful characters, Junior O'Malley, the racetrack figure, and people of that ilk, Dennis Lustig, our dwarf sports writer. It was, they made wonderful stories. So finally I did. I had the time. I couldn't, I don't know how people write a book while they're still working full time.
Sure, sure.
But I couldn't do it. But now I had the time. And so anyway, the first book, Crazy with the Papers to Prove It, was really well received. And then the second, I came out with the second one a little bit too soon. For this reason, people were confused. Is this a new book or is this the same old book he's talking about? No, that was Past the Nuts. And so now I've waited enough time, people will realize this is a new book, new stories, new anecdotes. And let me just throw a couple of my favorites out at you.
Sure, of course.
And that is the chapter on Canton McKinley football when they got the death penalty in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most people are not aware that McKinley didn't just get their wrist slapped. They got put on probation, and they were denied a football season in 1962 for recruiting violations. They went down to an assistant coach and a couple of McKinley supporters went down to Portsmouth and stole two football players, brothers,
okay,
Portsmouth, and they couldn't have done this more less subtly if they had shot off fireworks and had spotlights and say, hey, watch us. They went down. Summer practice had already started in August, and they went down and packed up this family with a truck and a trailer, moved them lock, stock, and barrel from Portsmouth. Now, they were already in August football practice. They were there one day. The next day, they were gone.
Wow.
They were now at Canton, practice for Canton McKinley. Moved them up, put them into an apartment in Canton, enrolled them in school, and you know, they just didn't take into consideration the fact that the Portsmouth coach might really be annoyed because he had previously coached in Canton.
Ah.
And a couple years before that, when the McKinley job opened up, he applied for it, and he didn't get it.
Wow.
So now he's head coaching in Portsmouth. And so he went to his principal. The principal went to the superintendent. The superintendent went to the Ohio High School Athletic Association. They conducted an investigation that took all fall, and they interviewed the OHSAA, interviewed everybody, including the janitor of the school.
Oh, my gosh.
It was in November when they came down with their ruling. Canton McKinley is suspended from football for 1 year. No team in 1962. Wow.
That's crazy.
Yes. Now, but this is why I love Stark County football so much. They did have a team, however. No games, except they had intramural scrimmages every Saturday afternoon. And 5,000 people came out to watch them every Saturday.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah, I believe it.
And then when they were supposed to be playing Massillon in Week 10 for their intra-squad scrimmage, Massillon sent their band over to play at their scrimmage.
Wow.
So and remember, and now 20 years ago, SMU got the death penalty.
Sure, sure.
And they still, Matt, haven't recovered.
No, you're right. And Camp
McKinley.
Just 1 year.
McKinley. Oh, they wound up, SMU wound up having, because they, so many consequences of them having no season in whatever it was in 86 or whatever, they wound up having to cancel the next season as well, SMU did. But
yeah.
Ken McKinley, the next year they came back, and in the final AP poll they were second in the state.
Wow.
So they bounced back. Anyway, Bob Stewart, you know, the former sports editor of the Canton
Repository,
he's still around down there. And so, anyway, he helped direct me to some things down there, and I spent a lot of time in the downtown library in Canton. And this is what I just had a delight writing that story. That's just one of 37 chapters or so. And another one that I really enjoyed doing was a chapter on Wally Pizorn, the proprietor of the Harbor Inn.
Okay.
Have you ever been to the Harbor Inn?
I have not,
Many?
No.
Well, it's a bar on the west side of the Flats. It's legendary. And Wally has finally put it up for sale, and he's got a deal going, but he's still running the place. And that was the darts capital of Ohio, really, for many years. Both Wally Pizorn and one of his partners in darts, they're both inducted into the not only the Cleveland Darters Hall of Fame, but the American Darters Hall of Fame.
Wow.
And Wally said that, yes. I said, wow, that's a big deal. Did you go to the induction ceremonies? They were somewhere in Michigan. He said, no, they didn't tell us about that. But it's, but they gave us a plaque.
Oh, there you go. So that plaque is probably proudly displayed, right, I would assume?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That place is so clettered, and, of course, it hasn't been cleaned in 50 years.
Oh, sure.
That it might be lost among the rubble in there,
but
it's still going strong.
That is amazing. You talk a little bit also, at least in the bio that I'm reading about the book, about some of the, obviously, our local teams, some of the owners that you dealt with for many, many years, and, of course, some of the great players. Give me some stories about some of these owners that you talk about.
Oh, okay. Here, you know what? This one, I always need to refresh myself. I didn't know him.
Mm-hmm.
But I have found out about him. I just got to find the name here. Got to find the name here.
No problem.
Find the name.
Again, we're talking with Danny Coughlin, of course, from Fox 8. Used to be Fox 8. Of course, one of the great sports writers of our time here in the local area. 2002 Society of Professional Journalists Cleveland Chapter Award. 1996 inductee to the Cleveland Press Club Journalism Hall of Fame. And as I mentioned earlier, the 1976 Ohio Sports Writer of the Year. Everybody knows you from Fox 8, Danny, but again, great background in writing and some of these great books. Again, great Christmas gift. Let's Have Another out right now. You can go to Grayco, GRAYCO.com to pick that up. Also available at Barnes & Noble and all the local bookstores, and you can also get it on Amazon and all those websites as well. Again, we're speaking with him a little bit today about the book. 26 black and white photos, stories about the Indians, the Browns, the Cavaliers, and, of course, local high school, and some great just local stories as well. And one of the great writers of our time here in the local area.
Yes.
So,
Boy, you've got that down pat, I'll tell you.
I should walk around with you and be your agent. Why not?
Could you travel around with me and do my introduction?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. Anyway, the name is Saul Silberman.
Okay.
Now, Saul once owned racetracks. He's dead now, of course. Saul owned Randall Park here in Cleveland.
Oh, right, okay.
That was where Randall Park Mall was.
Used to be, sure.
Yeah, where Randall Park Mall
used to be. Right.
Yeah, and he also owned Tropical Park in Miami, the racetrack that's been closed for decades. But anyway, he was from 1953 to 55, he wound up half owner of the Browns.
Gotcha. Wow.
And he had a partner from Tropical Park in Miami that had the same. Yeah, they were racetrack gambling people. Paul Brown remarked more than once. He said, "What a great owner he is! He is so interested in our team. He calls every week to see how we're doing, if we're healthy."
And wow,
Paul, come on, wise up, Paul.
Yeah.
Anyway, one day, Commissioner Burt Bell in 1955 pulled into town and he got the other owners together and said, "Get rid of this man or we will revoke your franchise in the NFL.
Wow.
He is gambling on every game."
Exactly.
He, you know, talk about players, he never missed a game. He didn't. He never missed a game.
Yeah, right. Wow.
You think Deacon had a longevity record, never missing a game? Saul Silberman. So I'm not sure that anybody ever knew about that.
Right.
I don't.
I never heard that story. That's amazing.
No, and that came from Bob Grease. Bob is still around.
Right.
His father was one of the owners of the Browns then, and Bob Grease was just around all that stuff then all of his life. Then there was another incident, and that was when the Browns were formed and when the league was formed. It was an outlaw league, really, the All-American Football Conference, and it was formed in 1946, and the Browns had already signed Bill Willis and Marion Motley,
sure.
Two great players who wound up in the Hall of Fame, and the other owners did not want Motley and Bill Willis on the team in the league because they envisioned, these are the new owners of this new league, they wanted an all-white league.
Sure.
And Mickey McBride, and of course, pro football, the NFL virtually had been all-white for years. Back in the early days, there were some African-Americans who played in the NFL, but by the late 40s, there weren't any. But Mickey McBride, who was the founding owner of the Cleveland Browns, he stood up, he bristled at them at a league meeting, and he told them what they could do with their league. He said, "If you want that, start your own league." They said, "Well, that's what we're
doing.
That's
what we'll do." Wow, that is crazy.
But anyway, he stood up to them, refused to back down, and by the next year, several other teams in the All-American Conference started signing black players, and the game's been changed ever since.
Yeah, it's amazing that, you know, like the...
But could you imagine that they openly said, "We don't want any, they called them Negroes, but we don't want any Negroes in our league."
It's amazing the difference, obviously, nowadays to back then, and, you know, the almost like the rebellion, you know, of guys that had to step up and say, "We want equality, we want," you know, the Jackie Robinsons, of course, of the world,
right.
and the players of that era who, basically, they weren't just fighting, Danny, for equality, they were fighting for their lives, you know, their professional lives.
And you mentioned Jackie Robinson, you know, his first sport really was football. He was an All-American at UCLA.
Exactly, right. And then, of course, became one of the greatest baseball players of our time. You know, talk a little bit, Danny, if you would. I mean, your career about spanning over, you know, 30, 40 decades. I mean, again, a lot of 50 years. A lot of people just know you from Fox 8 because of your antics and how great you were when you were on there and everything. But your sports writing career is so well documented, and now in these books, people get a chance to really relive that.
You know, really, I was a newspaper man for 18 years at the Plain Dealer, and before that, my first newspaper job was in a little town in Virginia called Lynchburg, Virginia.
Right.
And that's about 60 miles north of Charlottesville. Anyway, so I'm there fresh out of college, and I get my first newspaper job. And this, I didn't realize that we were We were in the South. Now, I was aware that there were, you know, social differences down there. But I was second man on a two-man sports staff. I had an old veteran sports editor, guy who had once worked in Washington, D.C., and loved the man. But here are the differences between Virginia and Cleveland back in the early 1960s. Here in Cleveland, we were very aware of, like, East Tech basketball.
Right.
They got eight-column headlines in the Plain Dealer when they won the state championships back to back, and they got every Saturday morning in the Plain Dealer. There were big headlines on the Senate games. East Tech wins again, and all this. So I'm down there in Lynchburg, and we are summer's drawing to a close, and high school football practice is starting, and then high school football season is starting. Now there were two high schools down there: white high school and a black high school.
Mm-hmm.
And they both used the same field. The black high school used it on Thursday nights, and the white high school used it on Friday nights. So anyway, the season's about to begin, and I say to the sports editor, I probably ought to do an advance on, I forget the name of the high school now, but, I mean, that goes back a long time.
Right.
But, probably ought to do an advance on their story, and we'll cover that game Thursday night. And he said, no, we don't cover them.
Wow.
What? They didn't even cover them.
Wow.
I imagine they didn't cover them. Things like graduations, graduation speakers and all that. No, I don't even remember them covering arraignments when people got traffic tickets and didn't show up. They just weren't covered.
That's crazy.
It was. So anyway, I've been in the newspaper business a few months, so I wasn't going to stand up and start a race riot on this thing. I was feeling my way along here, but before the year was out, I was drafted into the Army. But now, of course, everything has changed in Lynchburg, Virginia. But that was part of my education back then.
Sure.
You know?
That's incredible. That's incredible.
Yes, yes.
And talk to me a little bit. You know, once you got into TV, 1983 is when you joined Fox 8. And, you know, a lot of people don't remember, but you actually did a year with the Indians in 1990. You were the play-by-play announcer for Fox Sports.
Oh, yes, I was. Frankly, I wasn't very good.
I'm sure you were just fine.
After 1 year. No, I wasn't.
Well, tell me a little bit about that experience.
But actually, it was fun. I was the traveling beat writer for the Plain Dealer.
Yes.
On the Indians beat back in 78 and 79, and that was also every, you know, you go through life, and with every new experience and every new adventure, it's everyone is a learning experience.
Sure.
That was, I had a good time on the baseball beat, even though I pleaded to get off after 2 years.
Right.
Because that flying 50 to 55,000 miles a year.
It's a toll.
Wears you down,
yeah.
Right? So I was trying to court my wife, and I couldn't do it. You know, calling her saying, hey, how are things going? I'm in Anaheim. Where are you?
It's amazing. You look at, you know, even today, Danny, obviously, like Paul Hoynes, who's, I think one of the best guys around and one of the great friends of mine.
He's
industry.
Done it for so long. I don't know how he's been able to do it.
Right, 30-plus years, got a lovely wife who had just retired from a Mentor school district, I believe, just a few years ago. And, you know, again, 30-plus. I remember interviewing him a few years ago, and he was over 30 years. That was his 30th year.
Yes.
And imagine the miles that poor guy's got on his body just from traveling.
That's right.
Yeah,
And when I was on the beat, I got to know a lot of guys like that.
Right,
there
right.
were guys who, once they got on the baseball beat, never got off.
Right. It was a part of their life.
Guys,
right.
It was right. It was their life.
And it's amazing.
Especially there were so many guys that did it all their life.
Wow, it's an incredible, it's a different lifestyle. It really is. It's an absolutely just a totally different lifestyle when you get, you know, football. You travel, what, 10, 15 times a year? You know, you go to the away games. And I'm not downplaying what football beat writers go through, mind you. But basketball and baseball, those two beats are just, it's an every minute of every day type of situation. And, again, having to do it, you don't know it until you do it. You know what I mean?
For about 16 years or so, why I covered the Browns with Chuck Heaton, home and away.
Right.
I might just say I carried his typewriter for the away games. But... And those were, that was also, those were great years.
Right.
Covering the Browns in the 60s, 70s.
Oh, sure.
And into the 80s. It was fun covering them. Everything about them was different back then.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's, I mean, no one's smiling in the locker room. We had great times covering the Browns. But also, I had great weekends.
Mm-hmm.
I used to say that every Friday night, I would cover one of the biggest high school games around.
Right.
Then on Saturday, I would frequently cover a major football game. I covered like Miami of Ohio and Michigan State, Notre Dame. I would cover the big Notre Dame games. You know, we had a beat writer, Ed Shea, who covered all the Ohio State games for years.
Right.
And I would cover the other big game. And frequently it was Notre Dame, Purdue, Notre Dame, Michigan State, and the big bowl games that involved Notre Dame. And then on Sunday, I would meet up with the Browns wherever they were playing.
Wow.
People, I could say that the people worked all week so that if they could possibly do what I was doing every weekend during the football season.
Sure.
And
sure.
They paid me for doing it.
Wow.
Wow. Yes. Wow.
And you would have an opportunity, like you mentioned, Danny, in those years, there was just a different aura about the Browns because they were the staple franchise.
That's right. Yes. And you know, we really got to know the players. In fact, just last week I was out with Robert Jackson, and we were recalling how back in those days, why the media was just we weren't in anybody's pocket, but we were just welcomed
right
into the inside of the organization. We were in the locker room whenever we felt like it. There were no prohibitions against us. Everybody used common sense, and when Doug Deacon became the starting left tackle, middle of the 1970 or 71 season, whatever it was. Now, Dick Shaffrath had ruined his legs earlier that year, making a run on from Cleveland Stadium to his old high school stadium in Worcester. He was the only lineman we ever knew who at that time was so far ahead of his time. He was into long distance running. He was running low. And so he ran the 60 miles from Cleveland Stadium to his high school stadium on a sort of a challenge from George Lamb, the Chevrolet dealer down in Worcester. Said, "I'll give you the use of a Chevrolet for a year if you run from." And no, back in those days, the use of a car for a year was something. Nowadays,
it's nothing.
They can buy. Nowadays, these players can buy a dealership.
Right. Absolutely. Right.
In fact, a former player said to me once recently. He said that this team isn't 53 players all pulling in one direction. No.
Yeah.
These are 53 corporations.
Right. That's true.
Yeah. Wow. And when you look at it that way. No wonder you can't get everybody on the same page. Every corporation now is out to make the best deal for themselves.
Right. It's incredible.
But anyway,
returning
to yesteryear when Shaffrath ran his legs never recovered, running the city streets, the highways, 60 miles.
Wow.
He left at 7 o'clock on a Friday night and pulled into Worcester at 11:30 the next morning, and they had an ambulance waiting to take him to the hospital with IVs in his arms, and his legs never came back. By the middle of that season, it was obviously his legs were gone.
Right.
And so Deacon, a rookie, becomes a seventh-round draft pick who was a tight end at Illinois. He becomes the starting left tackle. And
wow.
I said, holy cow, this is only the third starting left tackle in Browns history. Actually, he was the fourth. There was one guy, Jim Daniel, who did it the first year in 46. Then Lou Groza, up until he turned it over to Dick Shaffrath. And so here was Deacon, essentially the fourth left tackle in Browns history, and he was held the job for 13 years. So I said, I've got to do a story. Who is this guy, Deacon?
Yeah.
He has just replaced a Browns legend here. He's in a succession of royalty. So the next morning after he's announced the starter, I meet him in the locker room about 8 o'clock in the morning, and he's sitting there smoking his cigarette and had a dip in his mouth, and he's spitting into the styrofoam cup. And well, I get his life story. You know, grew up in central Illinois on a farm, he didn't mention that his parents owned half of the farmland in central Illinois. That came out later. But anyway, so I had two brothers, and so anyway, I write the story, and the next day, I walk into the locker room early in the morning, and Doug is waiting for me, and he walks up to me with the holding the paper, and all he says is, "You killed my brothers." I said, "What? Look at this." So I begin the story. Here's Doug Deacon, New Browns' new left tackle. Here's his background, a farm, and two brothers. And then in the paragraph six, I say, "Deacon, comma, an only child." What?
Oh.
How did that happen?
Wow.
Well, I know how it happened, and I'll get to that in a couple of minutes. And so that started it with me and Deacon. Oh, had a wonderful relationship, and still do.
Wow.
I killed his brothers, he said. But and the reason is because Dennis Lustig's arms were too short. Because, see, it was hard to write a story in the Plain Dealer back then.
Right.
Because the phones are always ringing. It'd be in the morning paper, and we're working nights, you know, drunks in bars, getting in an argument, and who do they call? They don't call the Cleveland Press. They call the Plain Dealer.
Right, right.
And to ask us, because somebody always answers the phone in the Plain Dealer sports department. And they weren't even at the press. They weren't even into work. They don't get to work until early the next morning. So anyway, we'd have to answer these phone calls. There was sort of a, you know, we'd sort of take turns. Some who were more conscientious and more team-oriented, we'd answer the phone, and it would interrupt our train of thought as we're trying to write these stories. And that's exactly what happened with the Deacon thing. Between the first paragraph and the sixth paragraph, I must have been interrupted three times with phone calls, people wanting to know the race results or the score or something. Or did anybody ever hit a ball into the center field bleachers?
Right,
right to ask Hal for that.
That's it, yeah, right.
So anyway, Dennis Lustig was hired in 1964 when Hal became the sports editor, Hal Lebovitz. He, to alleviate this problem of us constantly having to answer these calls, he said to us one day, "I've got a good present for you guys. I've hired somebody to answer the phones for you." Oh, hallelujah, thanks. And he said, now, he's 20 years old, and he doesn't know anything about the newspaper business, but he does know sports.
Wow.
Thank God somebody's there to answer the call. He shows up for work, and he's a dwarf. He's not only short, but other dwarfs called him Shorty. We once measured him on the sports copy desk with a printer's ruler, and he turned out he was like just over 3.5 feet long. And so, but anyway, his arms are too short, as it turns out, to reach the phone boxes. Every desk in the sports department had this phone box with toggle switches on it to 10 lines, flip up or down to when the lights would light up, and he was expected to click up on 4173. Hey, yes, sir, and Ed Shea, this is for you. And then, hey, Dan, this is for you. So, but his arms are too short to reach the phone boxes. So
what do you do?
He couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And his legs were too short to run for coffee, so they made a reporter out of him.
That's crazy.
And that's how Dennis Lustig became a reporter.
Wow.
But that's how I killed Deacon's two brothers, because we still had nobody to answer the phones. But Dennis, he had a... So now he's a reporter, and so he developed this little franchise, Where Are They Now?
Mm-hmm.
And he would find some athlete of the past and update them. What are they doing now in retirement or whatever they're doing? And so one time he did a little Where Are They Now? And somebody who played for the Indians in about 1941. And in writing this little, just short little 8-10 paragraphs, what are they doing now? He referred to his manager, the late Roger Peckinpah. And so the next day, I'm in there, and the phone rings, and it's my sort of my turn. I answer it, and the boy says, "Could I please speak to Dennis Lustig?" So, "Yes, sir, hold on. Dennis, call for you on 76. And he was able to crawl across the desk to him, flick his little. And he said, "Who is it?" I said, "Who can I say is calling, sir?" And he said, "Oh, this is the late Roger Peckinpah."
He said he was dead.
Yeah, Roger lived in Shaker Heights and read the Plain Dealer
every day. Oh, no.
Yes.
That's great. What a story.
Now, Roger, of course, was old. Nobody had heard from him or about him for years. So this was, I don't know, we're talking probably the late 60s when this occurred. And about 5 years later, the guy walks down from the classified department. Back then, the death notices are called in, and they still, the death notices in the plane dealer, that's a classified ad, by the way.
Sure, absolutely.
It goes into the classified department. Usually the funeral home calls it in, and it's somebody in classified who takes it. And if there's somebody that they think, gee, they may want to do a story on it, they make a carbon of everything. Somebody came down one day from the classified department and said, we got this death notice of a guy who supposedly was once an Indians manager, it says, and Roger Peckinpah. Anybody here interested in this? And Dennis looked up from his typewriter and said, I had that story 5 years ago.
That's great. Oh, my goodness.
What a story.
And that's just some of the great stories. And again, let's have another Danny Coughlin's new book.
But now that story, those two stories I just told you about Deacon and Dennis Lustig, they went back to the first book.
First book, right. The first
Crazy
book.
Crazy with the papers to prove.
Right. Well, I want to talk about one story.
But I've got equally, you know, like these stories about the Browns owners and all that. That's in this current book.
Right.
Let's have another.
Well, I read the story you wrote in this book about Albert Bell. And I love the story because I can relate, because he's one of the guys that when I first started in the industry in 94, I got to cover for you know, 2 years until he took off to Chicago. And I remember well the Tony Tomsic story, the story about the photographer for Sports Illustrated who came into town. And, of course, you know, Albert went after him. So let's relive that story a little bit, because this is one of those stories, as you know, a lot of fans in Cleveland still beloved Albert Bell. But if you didn't cover Albert Bell, you didn't know what you had to deal with, and you of course dealt with him. And honestly, the Tony Tomsic story to me still relates because I remember the incident. Let's talk a little bit about Albert Bell and your memories
of him. Albert was an evil man. Tomsic, of course, is a native of Cleveland Heights High. Now, of course, he started at the Cleveland Press, and later Sports Illustrated picked him up because he was such a great photographer. And anyway, he still lives here in Rocky River.
Right.
And anyway, they were always flying him around the world, Olympics and things like that. But he always based still right here in Cleveland. So anyway, they were doing a cover story on Albert Bell. And so Tony was down there taking shots of Albert and during the stretching. And while he was doing the stretching, Albert wagged his finger at Tony Tomsic to stop shooting him.
Right, yeah. I remember that.
And so he stopped for briefly, but then here's Albert now in short center field playing a long toss with somebody else, and so Tony is shooting him. Now, Albert knows this is for a cover story in Sports Illustrated.
He just didn't care?
He did not. He just wanted to be mean about
it. Right.
And so, in fact, he was crazy. He is crazy.
Yeah.
And so, the next thing, Tony says, he's looking through the viewfinder at him, and Albert throws the ball, and Tony is aware of something whizzing past his head, and it rattles against the empty plastic seats in Jacobs Field then. And he said, if you rifled a ball into those plastic seats, it would sound like a gunshot.
Right.
And so out there, Albert shouted at him. He said, stop taking my picture, you asshole.
Mm-hmm.
We can say this on your podcast.
Oh, of course,
right?
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, I always apologize before asking for permission.
No worries.
Anyway, and Tony said, I shouted, what'd you say? And he repeated it. So the next thing, he's shooting him. And now Albert rifles a ball right at him, hits him in the hand, cuts his hand, blood all over the place. And the Indians trainer, Jimmy Warfield, takes him inside to the locker room and bandages him up. And so he wasn't gonna do anything about it.
Right. Tomsic didn't want to do anything. Right. He wanted to let it go.
Right. That's right. And but other people, the writers, would not let him.
Yeah.
A guy from Boston, Dan Shaughnessy or somebody wrote about it. And 2 weeks later, it was written about here in our papers here. And this thing escalated to the fact that people almost demanded that Tony take action, file a complaint, sue him. And so he sued him. Now, during the course of this, this thing goes on during the winter, and in the spring now, during spring training, Tony's down there in spring training when Oral Hershiser is there. And he said, one day in spring training, Hershiser walks up to him and said, Tony, how come nobody ever called me to take my deposition on you? He said, what? Oral Hershiser said, I was standing next to Albert out there in the outfield.
Wow.
And I said, you shouldn't have done that. Apologize to him. Go in there right now and apologize to him. And he wouldn't.
Wow.
So Oral Hershiser says, yeah, I'm going to get involved because it's the right thing to do. People said, why do you want to get involved in anything about Albert Bell, especially this deal? He said, because it's the right thing to do. And when his testimony in the lawsuit, that led to a fine settlement from Albert Bell. And I don't know, it must have been probably a nice settlement.
Oh, sure, 16 years.
I know that, Tony is still driving an American-made Toyota.
It's so incredible because people, again, if you didn't cover those 90s Indians teams, you know, everybody looks at them as the carefree, fun-loving teams. And I'm not saying that a lot of guys were. Tomey, Alomar, Espinoza, Oral was great to cover. Nagy.
Yes.
Eddie Murray and Albert Bell, not so much.
And Kenny Lofton.
And Kenny Lofton would look at you with that look if you asked him a question that he didn't like you would just ask the dumbest question in the world.
Well, you're just trying to get some kind of a response,
yeah,
you know?
It.
And they just wanted to make it hard on everybody just because they got their jollies off doing it.
Yeah, they did. It's just, again, one of the great stories from the new book, Let's Have Another with Dan Coughlin. Dan, I know you're busy and you got a lot of great things coming up. Any book signings that we can look forward to?
Oh, yes. I've got quite a schedule here that's already building. let me find my – I've got a list here that Oh, stay with me.
That's
while
all right.
I get my here.
Well,
let's remind people,
crazy with the papers to prove it, pass the nuts, and now the new book that's just out, Let's Have Another.
I did my first official book signing a week ago Saturday.
Okay.
And that was at the West End Tavern in Lakewood. I do very well in tavern.
I couldn't tell at the cover of this book. Let's put it that way.
My next one is November 24th at the Westlake Village Assisted Living.
Okay.
Those old people, they're sitting out there with nothing to do, and they all have $15 in their purses.
There you go.
And so I'm doing one there. At November 28th, the GPS gift store in Rocky River.
Oh, very nice.
And that's a block away from St. Christopher's Church on Detroit Road in Rocky River. Then November 29th, the Fireside Bookstore in Chagrin Falls, 1 to 3 that day, November 29th. December 5th, the Wahoo Club Christmas Party in Bedford, 11 to 1.
Oh, very nice.
December 19th, I'm back at GPS Gifts again in Rocky River, 10 to 12. That same day, I'm then doing an afternoon at the Learned Owl Bookstore in Hudson. Isn't that the greatest name for a bookstore?
Yeah, it really is.
The Learned Owl.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Oh, and by the way, I did a signing at my son Joe's Quick Car Wash just last week on Veterans Day.
There you go.
Veterans Day.
That's great.
Yes,
and you, of course, are a veteran.
Did all that already.
Yeah. Did you go get a free meal anywhere? That's the question.
No, but I got a free wash.
Well, I would hope so if your son owns it. Jeez. Well, again, Danny, we appreciate the time, and thank you again for all the great things that you provided us with, all the entertainment over the years. You could still see him, everybody, on Fox 8 on Friday nights during high school, during the high school coverage during the season. You're doing a game this weekend, I assume?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm not. The show is over.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Friday Night Lights.
Now we don't have enough games to... to do an entire half an hour show. So you're going to have to wait till the end of next August for me to reappear on. Although, let me see, I was on the Riz Sunday night show.
Yes.
And I'm probably going to, and I've been on the Fox 8 morning show. And if I could get on that New Day Cleveland, that'll be my trifecta of Channel 8.
The trifecta of life.
Well, hey, I'll tell you what, Rizzo should do a half an hour on you because he's got nothing else to talk about right now. With
I was on his radio show, too, by the way.
There you go. There you go. Of course, the really big show on WKNR with Gerard Cherry. And I watched the show last night, Danny. Just a quick second here on the Browns. What do you do?
Well,
blow it up again, or?
Well, they've got to replace Farmer, and Patton has lost soul there.
Yeah, he is.
He has no talent.
No, you're right.
No talent on that team. I thought this was, everybody thought that this was supposed to be such a great offensive line. It isn't.
Oh, it's terrible.
But what the hell has happened to this offensive line?
Yeah.
My God.
17 yards on 15 carries yesterday, or 15 yards on 14 carries?
I think it was 15 yards.
And Johnny Manziel had 17 of those yards. I mean, Isaiah Crowell was negative 5 yards. I don't know if I've ever seen a stat line so bad.
No.
I mean, it was just, it's incredible.
It's terrible, but you know what? That's happening throughout the NFL. There were several other games where rushing yardage was not unlike what the Browns just went through. And by the way, the Steelers didn't do much on the ground either.
No, but they could throw the ball, so they got it done. You know, I mean, they could still throw the football. And they got some guy there that the Browns had a chance to draft in 2004 who was an Ohio kid who they passed on to go get a tight end named Kellen Winslow II, if you will. And now look at how it's blown up in their face. I think Ben Roethlisberger is something like 30-9 against the Browns in his career, or 30-6 or something. I mean, it's incredible.
Have we beaten him that often?
You know what? I'm going to take that back. I think it's 3 or 4 times. I think it's like 30-4, 30-5. But Tomlin has never lost to the Browns in Heinz Field. It's incredible. It's just, you know, I mean, the Browns haven't won there since 2003. And obviously, you know this from your experience. They didn't win in Three River Stadium until 1985. You know, so it's just, it's an incredible, or 86, I think it was their first time they won in Three Rivers. And that stadium opened in 1972. So for whatever reason.
1970.
You're right. 72 was the Immaculate Reception year. But, you know, it is incredible. And unfortunately for Browns fans everywhere, it's been yet another painful season. And I don't know. There's not much you can do with that unit right now.
Well, it's the curse for this expansion team, allowing that multi-billionaire Al Lerner to get a hold of this team.
Right.
And because there was no way to stop him because he just outbid everybody. You know?
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't rigged so he would get it. They held an honest auction, and the Dolan brothers went with them for till it was up to $600 million.
Yeah.
And then they realized this man is not going to stop. He has, you know, a bottomless pit of money.
Right.
And based on all his usurious fees from the credit cards he charged people.
Oh, sure.
And
that's
so
incredible.
If the Dolan brothers had gotten this team, we would have been in a couple of Super Bowls by now.
Yeah, probably.
Because their football expert was going to be Don Shula.
Right. They were going to bring it. Is it the Cosby
and
Shula
era? Was Cosby part of that?
I thought it was Cosby and Shula, to be honest.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Oh,
well,
wow.
Let's not get into that.
But
by
Shula
now, that would have changed. The regime would have changed.
Shula was going to put together their football organization, and he knew how to do it.
Yeah. Instead, you got Dwight Clark and Carmen Policy.
And they had a mob lawyer from Youngstown.
Yep.
In charge of the football operation.
Ugh.
And we are still paying for that. And of all people to get the brass of this guy, Lerner, he was responsible for Art Modell winding up in Baltimore.
Right.
Instead of bailing out his good friend. So we have been cursed because he winds up with the team.
It's incredible. And now, again, you're talking an owner, two owners, really, if you count his son, Randy Lerner. And not only are you talking two owners, you're talking, I mean, what, 9, 10 coaches, I believe it is now. And you're going to have another one. I don't think there's any question you're going to have another one next year. And
Haslam is as inept as Randy Lerner
right,
was.
Right, absolutely.
But Randy Lerner knew he knew nothing about football.
Where Jimmy thinks he does.
Jimmy thinks he does.
Yeah, Jimmy thinks
he does. That's the difference, yes.
Well, again, Danny Coughlin, the book is called Let's Have Another at major bookstores around the area. And, of course, you can get it online, Amazon, and, of course, Grayco, GRAYCO.com is the website. You can order that book along with his other two books, Pass the Nuts and Crazy with the Papers.
If you want to trot out to this assisted living place on November 24th, you can pick it up there.
I would love to come and take some photos of that. I think that would be amazing to watch you, signing books for the old people.
I do very well because, obviously, I tell stories from long ago.
Sure, absolutely.
And this is right up their alley. Remember many of these people.
Yep, I bet. And they all read you, of course, for the many years you were in The Plain Dealer, and also know you, of course, from WJW, as they used to call it, TV, now Fox 8, here in Cleveland.
Yes.
So, Danny, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Always good to catch up with you. Best of luck this holiday season with the book, and let's have another out in major bookstores right now. Appreciate it, my friend.
I'm looking forward to getting together with you again, Matt. Thanks for having me on your show.